Hey, welcome to When Songs Mean Business. I'm your host, Steph Belcher. Today I'm talking with Cynthia Katz. She is an attorney in New York City, and we dive really deep into copyright law and how to protect the intellectual property that you're creating when you record a new song. I really hope you enjoy this episode. It was a joy for me to record it. Cynthia is so brilliant, and I love the way that she described everything in this episode because some of these topics can be really confusing, and she made it so easy to understand. So I hope you enjoy it. As always, please follow us on Instagram at When Songs Mean Business and check out our Patreon, When Songs Mean Business. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me. My website is stephbelcher.com. I am always available for you. Thank you so much for listening. I get all of your messages, and I am ready for you to hear everything that Cynthia presents. So please check out the show notes to follow her. And again, follow us on social media for more information. And have a wonderful day. Check out this episode. It's going to be awesome. Cynthia, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, this is great. I love talking to lawyers. I grew up with a bunch of lawyers. In my family, I had like this whole chain of grandparents, aunts, uncles that all ended up going to law school. And I thought I was going to go to law school until I actually started reading legal cases and realizing what law school really meant. And then I was like, yeah, I don't really know if this is a great fit for me. But, you know, having ended up in accounting, I deal a lot with attorneys. So it's nice to chat with you.
It's so nice to hear that because, you know, it's often the opposite that most people, even my husband, if you asked him, probably would say they hate talking to attorneys, but hopefully this will be fun. And at least as far as the law goes, I think music law is one of the most fun areas. So I feel super lucky to kind of end up here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love to start at the beginning, whatever that means for you, whether that's the beginning of your music career or the beginning of your legal career, wherever you want to start. But when did you figure out that you wanted to work in the music business?
So, I mean, I think like a lot of people as a teenager, as a kid, adolescent, I always was thinking about what do I want to do? That was something that was always, you know, on my mind. And at that time, entertainment is cool. You know, I mean, it still is cool today, but, you know, I don't think most people say, you know, I want to grow up to be a trusted estates lawyer. It's just not, you know, what you think about. So I said, I want to work in entertainment. And there were several members of my family who had sort of touched on it, you know, and kind of told me, look, everybody wants to do that. It's the hardest. That's why it's the hardest thing to get into. And in order to do it, you need to be the smartest in the room because you have no talent, which is true. I have, you know, no, I don't sing, I don't play an instrument. So, you know, I knew I was going to have to come at it from a business angle because I was never going to make it, you know, I was never going to be the talent, but I did very well academically in school. And so, you know, that obviously afforded me more options to say, I would like to work for this company or that company. Whereas, you know, if you don't do as well in school, you sort of fall into, I get the job that I get. And it just kind of goes from there. So when I went to college, I did a dual degree with Wharton Business School and University of Pennsylvania. There's a huge push at Wharton to work in finance. Most people go into, you know, the Goldman Sachs of the world and they make a ton of money. I didn't really want to do that. I wanted to use the business knowledge, not to be in finance, but to be on the business side of entertainment. So when I first graduated, I started working for Men's Health magazine, actually, and helped launch Women's Health magazine, which, yeah, that was really, really fun there. It's crazy now to think that there was no Women's Health then because it's blown up so much at this point. And in sort of forming that company, I worked in marketing as marketing manager, and we did that. A lot of it was entertainment-based because entertainment is a part of marketing, and particularly in the publishing media space, a lot of it was aligning with the right entertainment celebrities that kind of helped build the brand image. and it was super fun. And we had all of, you know, I was young and we had, you know, events with live performance and all of that. And I was like, this is awesome. This is sort of what I want to do. But I always felt I wanted one more degree just because in my family, everyone had been to graduate school of some sort. And I just felt having the legal piece to go with the business piece would sort of help round out the credentials. So I went to law school. And while I was doing that, I ended up working at EMI Music, Capitol Records, Virgin, all of that in their business affairs department, legal and business affairs, which is sort of the perfect place too, where your role is kind of half business and half legal, because, you know, your business, your assets is largely, at that time, it was really based on copyrights, which is a legal concept, you know, and trademarks of the branding and name and likeness rights, you know, the right to sort of promote the artist. So it's an industry that is, the business has a legal aspect to it, you know, from day one, and it's super fun. And I worked there for a couple of years and it was the greatest working experience. And I say that not just for me, but everybody who worked there loved their job. Every person I know who sort of worked at any point for EMI loved it. It was just a great atmosphere. Great people worked there. To this day, some of my partners and several clients all were part of the EMI family at one point. And as far as the majors go in music, you know, at that point, EMI was a major, and then you had Warner, Sony, and Universal, but EMI was the smallest of the majors, and it was the only one that was solely and primarily focused on music, where, you know, obviously Sony has a million other divisions, but, you know, TV and film is a big part of their business. Universal's got a million other things going on, Warner too. I think also, you know, EMI had had the Beatles, which sort of changed music forever. So we had this kind of air that, like, you know, we were going to get the best music and the up and cut, you know, and it was a really fun place to be. And my plan was to work there after I graduated law school. Towards the end of law school, the internet and Napster and just all of that happened and completely destroyed the music industry. I mean, we had a day, I don't remember what they call it, like Black Thursday or something. There must have been 500 people fired a day for several days. And you would hear people screaming, you know, and throwing papers out the window. I mean, and it was just devastating. And then obviously EMI went bankrupt and had to be sold off to Universal and Sony. And there was no more music industry to work in. And people that I talked to and everyone, particularly just coming out of law school, you know, working at a label anyway, they don't have, it's not like a law firm where you have 40 lawyers, you know, you're going to have very few. So you're only going to, you know, have one or two positions, and they're going to be experienced people who know what they're doing. And particularly when there was less money, you know, they were cutting departments, there was no jobs to be had. So at that point, I also had sort of a strong background from Wharton Business School in entrepreneurship, and, you know, startup companies was another area that was really exciting to me. Particularly, there's a lot of entertainment, technology, startups, you know, let's try and get ahead of the whole, you know, like, let's be the Spotify's, kind of, let's find a way to make this work from a technology perspective. And there were a lot of companies doing really cool things in that space, trying to figure it out. Ultimately, Spotify was the one, you know, the first one to really get it in a way that worked and move it. But there was a lot of people trying to figure it out at that time. So I ended up doing corporate, going to work for a corporate law firm that primarily represented startups. I had a, I worked with some people that I knew from Wharton. We had a platform that helped get angel funding for startups, which touches on securities law a lot, and was another interesting area. And that was kind of evolving at that time too, you know, the laws around raising capital and the stock market, because there had been the crash and I guess it was 2008. And there was a lot of push, you know, how are we going to change the regulations to make this not happen, but also not thwart innovation and make it too hard to have access to capital. So I worked in that space for a while, transitioned to at one point just representing larger corporations in their general M&A practice.
What's M&A?
Mergers and acquisitions. Oh, so okay. It's essentially, yeah, just companies, you know, coming together, breaking apart, buying one company, buying another company, that kind of stuff. And then about, I think, gosh, at this point, maybe it's 6 years ago, 5, 6 years ago, something like that. I sort of came back full circle and ended up going back to work for a music law firm, first a smaller boutique firm where they had sort of developed a corporate role in the music firm because the music business was changing once again, because now it's thriving and healthy and doing great. And so much so that Wall Street is now interested in a way that they never were before in the music industry, where they're seeing predictable, continuously growing revenue streams. So something that we have from streaming that we did not have before is much more data. We have so much more data, so we can model much better predictions of how much money things are going to make over time. And there's sort of a new look. Wall Street has started to look at music assets in a much different way, and they all want to invest and they all want a piece of it, and they see it as an industry on the rise. So this whole sort of now there's all the private equity and all of the venture capital firms want a piece of music. And that has then, they're competing with the majors who said, wait a second, this is our, you know, sector. We own stuff. You don't own stuff. But that competition now has driven the prices up significantly for people who own music related assets. So this has boomed into a huge business in and of itself. So that's where I work now. Sometimes I represent talent. We have a lot of very successful bands and artists who are a little bit older, because what has happened is as you get older, sometimes contractually, if you might have signed an agreement 20 years ago, giving away your rights, you sometimes get them back. Mm-hmm. And there have also been some changes in copyright law to allow artists and songwriters to elect to take their rights that they may have sold and take them back 35 years after the original agreement. So a lot of times I represent the artists and the talent, and we then go and sort of shop their, you know, they take their right, we help them get their rights back. And then we flip their catalog of works to someone else who wants to buy it and make them a lot of money. Sometimes I represent labels who own, if they had a bunch of artists and they actually own the copyrights, they themselves can move those assets around to generate money. And then sometimes I represent a lot of funds, private equity funds and other buyers who from Wall Street side who want to get in on it and all of this buying and selling of music assets. And then the traditional, which is all of this has also impacted the way that the publishers and the labels do their deals in the first place. So some part of my day is doing straight music, traditional music work, like, you know, signing publishing deals and recording deals. And some of it is also creating side ventures for our talent or running those businesses where, you know, everyone's got merch and a lot of artists have an alcohol company or a cannabis company or, you know, something else that they're doing with their brand. And I, you know, sort of help with the business side of that. So that would be the full circle story of how I got into what I'm doing now.
That's amazing. You have your hands in all of the important essential stuff. And
I hope so. It's with the one part that I don't actually make the product.
Yeah. So, but you help protect it. And if it wasn't for that protection part, then there would just be chaos everywhere. So I would love to, you touched on so many important lessons for the students that I would love to come back to. So let's start with kind of the overall idea that you're creating intellectual property. And if you could, from a legal standpoint, define intellectual property for the students, for the listeners and the students, and help them sort of wrap their brain around the fact that they're making something new and original and that that needs to be protected. And then how to be proactive about protecting it.
Sure. So the whole concept of property in and of itself is essentially a bundle of rights. When you say you own a house or you own a car, it's the right to stop other people from using it, the right to use it yourself, the right to, you know, protect it, the right to use it to do certain things or not to do certain things. So every form of property is essentially a bundle of rights. And when we talk about intellectual property, we're just talking about the rights that surround intangible assets. So, you know, it's easy to say a car, if I own it, you know, I have certain rights. I don't have the right to do whatever I want to do with it. I can't drive it 200 miles an hour, you know, on whatever street, but I can stop my neighbor from going into it or something like that. And it's easy to identify it as a car. Certain types of ideas or things like songs, music, which are intangible, but you can create or you can get from somebody else, or you could have somebody create for you, is still a form of property, and you still have certain exclusive rights that you have. So the major forms of intellectual property are copyrights, patents, and trademarks. You can protect certain types of intangible things, and others you can't. Just a general idea or a word that is not unique, you know, those belong to everyone. You can never say, I own the word computer, and nobody else can say that word. But if you, in certain contexts, the law, it's all, you know, the law will give you certain rights to have exclusivity with respect to certain intangible things. So when you talk about music, it's actually pretty complicated. You have two parts to every single song. You have the master and you have the composition. The composition is the lyrics and the notes, you know, the music that somebody writes and creates. And if it is original, if you did not copy somebody else or use, you know, just take elements that were already out there, you know, if you put them together in an original way so that it's special to you, then you can get a copyright in that arrangement that, or those words that you put together. And for a certain period of time, the law will say, nobody else can, you know, make money off of this or use it in a certain, you know, without your permission, is essentially what it boils down to. And there's a lot of nuance and specifics about how you register your rights with the Copyright Office and how you put the public on notice about it, and, you know, different standards for, there's sort of things called fair use, ways in which even if somebody owns it, other people can use it for educational purposes or things like that. The second part of every song is a master, which is the actual singing, the actual recording of those lyrics and those words, which gets fixed in, it used to have to be like a phono record, which would be a CD or a tape or a 45 or some tangible piece. Now a phono record comes to an MP3 or an MP4 is also it's digital, but it's still a tangible capture of that, you know, that recording that can be replayed over and over. So you have rights. The person who sings or performs and makes the song has certain rights, and the person who wrote the song has certain rights. And often there's multiple people on both sides. You know, if you have five people performing on a song, and you might have, you know, four writers, and you have to look at everyone else who contributed. You also have a producer who often has rights, sometimes on both sides or on one side. And sometimes when something is created, it's also negotiated who has these rights. Whereas a label can say, you know, we're going to own the rights as what's called a work made for hire, where you're doing it, but you're agreeing in advance that you're doing it as our, you know, employee, agent, whatever, and we own it. Sometimes producers don't actually write, but they negotiate with the songwriter and say, hey, you give me 2% of the writing credit, you know, as part of my compensation. So these things can be negotiated and traded around. But ultimately we come up with these are the people who own the various rights. And then when you own the rights, it usually means, okay, so let's just say you own 15% of the song. So that would mean the owners have the exclusive rights to do certain things like make a copy of it or perform it live or whatever. There's different bundles of rights for different aspects, but then anytime somebody does that, you get money as a result of it, because the law says, you know, you have to, in some cases, it's a statutory license where the law says a bar can go, if you put out a song, a bar can go and play it live if they want to. They don't need to come and ask permission, but they need to to pay royalties into this fund, which ultimately gets paid out to the creators. And sometimes it says you cannot, on the master side, even more so, if you wanted to make a, you know, sell a CD, make a copy, you have to go get a license. You have to go ask the person who owns the rights, can I do it? And generally, yes, you can pay me XYZ, you know, amount of dollars. Generally, everything is paid out in royalties, or sometimes we talk about points, but the same thing, it's just a percentage of the money that flows back to the original creators. And along the way, other people often take, so, you know, pieces of the pie, distributors and platforms and, you know, but we try to get as much of the money as we can back to the creators as compensation for, you know, they have the exclusive rights to do something and they're granting people permission to use it. And then they get money in exchange. And the idea is that, you know, this incentivizes people to be creative and to make new things because it they have the ability to make money off of it. Yeah. So that, you know, that's why they would do it. And it seems, you know, to work without these protections, if you could write a song and tomorrow, you know, someone could overhear you and just take it and go make money, you know, and there would be no reward to the fruit of your labor. You know, the idea is people would not put so much time and energy into creating things because, you know, they'd have to go out and get a job as a garbage man, you know? So yeah, we try to incentivize people to create art. And then in order to do that, we need laws protecting it, and we need people to sort of sit around and work on protecting it and making sure that they get money. So there's whole industries around that. I mean, that was what was so upsetting when we had this whole system in place. And, you know, while some people said the labels and the publishers were taking too much because they had too much control, which is possibly an argument, but there was still a system in place to compensate people. And then when the internet came and everyone was just violating the law and doing what they wanted to do, but it was everyone. So it was like, we can't sue everyone. You know, what do we do? And I do think that when that first happened, it had a somewhat of a chilling effect on the amount of creativity that happened. You know, it was less profitable, so less records were getting made, less people were getting deals, you know, less art was getting out there. Ultimately now, I think, you know, maybe you had to go through those growing pains to get to where we are, because now in some ways there's less of a bottleneck. Now we have more creators because, you know, they're more independent people. You don't have to get signed by a label to get on Spotify. You can put yourself up on TuneCore. You can, you know, now, well, I think a lot of independent creators would say the money is still not where it needs to be, but at least, you know, now we have more avenues, you know, to get it out there and take a chance. So, I mean, the music industry has, and I think will continue to change a lot as technology changes, but I think we're in a pretty good place now.
Yeah, I would agree based on my own experience with all that too. You know, when you were talking about that void when there was just no jobs, that was right when I graduated from undergrad. And it was the kind of thing where the labels had already started laying people off. And so it was either unpaid internship with no potential for advancement, or you're competing for these kind of like entry-level jobs with a whole bunch of people who had just been laid off, and kind of everybody moved into live music too. And that was, there was just so much competition for jobs. And so we all had to be entrepreneurial and just sort of hustle and scramble and find whatever work we could. So I love to hear that you kind of moved into that startup area, helping people. It seems like you've always been helping people bring their ideas to life, helping them protect their ideas and make sure that they get moved from inside the brain through the legal process out into the world. So I think that's really cool that you've done that.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's, you know, the same sort of thing. I mean, it's a different type of property, but if you come up with a technology or a way of doing something, I mean, that's what startup companies are. They're, everyone has an idea that they think they can do something different than it's been done or better, or, you know, maybe it's a whole new product that they invented or just a different system that they have, and you know, they want to take a chance and get out there and compete. And of course, in order to do that, you generally need money to make it happen. So, you know, try to help you know, entrepreneurs get their business, get the money that they need to do it, and then of course protect what they're doing so that, you know, if it doesn't, somebody doesn't steal it essentially, and they can, you know, grow it and it will have value and they can bring it out there. It's sort of a very, in an abstract, it's the same kind of concept as whether you're making a song or a widget or whatever it is that you're doing. If you're creating something, you need a little help usually with money to get it going. And then you need, you know, someone to help protect it and watch it grow and then kind of get it out there in the market. So I really think, and I feel that we're seeing, you know, people think of themselves as artists. I think sometimes they get scared or just turned off by the whole business side of it, but you really can't have one without the other. And if you won't delve into the business part, that makes you vulnerable because you're going to have to rely on other people to do that. And you're going to have to make sure that you pick the right people, you know, to do it right and not to take advantage of you. And just in general, particularly when it's something that you're creating, you're going to have a love for it and an attachment to it. And so if you want to be able to protect it the best way that you can, I think it's sort of on you. And obviously, you know, Beyonce is not also doing her own taxes. I mean, I'm not saying you have to be, you know, you can't do everything, but the more at least that you understand the business aspects, I think the better that helps you protect the thing that you care about the most, which is, you know, your art. So I think everyone going into it saying, I'm a songwriter or I'm a creative or, you know, I'm an amazing singer, understand what it means. You know, I think it's imperative that you understand what, should I have a company? What kind of team should I put around me? Understanding what kinds of deals, you know, are the smart deals to make and when to make them. Are essential. And I mean, I think a big part of that is, you know, as you'll see, every artist has a team, and picking the right team, you need really good financial management. And particularly for the music industry, it's different a little bit than the accounting for other industries. You have to understand royalties and be able to read royalty statements. And someone who has experience knowing, okay, these are the people these were my collaborators. This is when they need to get paid. This is how the statements come in from the various payors. And this is when and how I should audit and kind of just running all of that. You know, obviously you have your personal manager if you are at a level where you can have a personal manager who's supposed to go out there and fight for you in terms of, you know, building your brand and helping you pick, you know, what kind of deals to do. And sometimes they also do your booking for live. Sometimes if you're huge enough, you know, you have separate booking, but that piece, and then your lawyer as well. And, you know, sometimes however big you get, these people will also have a, you know, maybe you have a separate PR or something like that. But I think the core team is your management and your attorney. And then you can sort of go off to the races, but you know, understanding the different types of deals that are out there, what the difference is between a co-pub and a publishing administration, and, you know, what kind of record deal you want, if you're, you know, should take a bigger advance and, you know, give up more of your copyright ownership, or if you should do more of a short-term license and take a smaller advance, and whether, you know, how much you want to put into physical versus digital. I mean, there's a lot of decisions to be made in terms of running your business as an artist. And even just picking, I know some indie artists who make a lot more money than some artists who are signed to majors. And sometimes, you know, understanding that what's best for you and your specific type of music and you know, place is different. And some people like to tour, you know, a lot more, and some people like to, you know, be in the studio a lot more. So there's a lot of different ways to structure a career where there's a lot of decisions. and you know, sort of understanding how the industry works and building a great team is kind of what you have to do. But I'd say, you know, right now is a pretty good time for the industry for those who are looking to get into it. And, you know, I do think touring, you know, took a break during the pandemic. I don't know. We'll see what happens with that. But at least the pandemic has shown, I think, and for obviously for my clients and stuff, even those that could not tour, there were other digital, you know, obviously the big boom of NFTs, which I don't know if you, but has happened now. I mean, using technology to find other revenue sources other than just touring, I think is something that, you know, is available to us now, where we are with technology, that whatever happens, I feel like the music industry is in a better place to be able to weather the storm than they were when the internet first came, and it was just like a complete shock to everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to talk for a minute about the idea of protecting your song in the event that it would get stolen, or protecting your copyright in the event that it gets stolen. That might seem like a really foreign concept to a young, unknown musician who's thinking, nobody's ever going to steal my stuff. Why would I need to put a copyright on it? Nobody's ever going to steal it. What would you say to somebody who's listening to this right now and thinking, oh, I don't have to worry about that. I'm just going to put my music out there. And, you know, if somebody steals it, I'll deal with it when it happens.
It's not a good idea. For one, there is a law that says basically if you do not have a registration already in place with the Copyright Office at the time that the infringement takes place, you cannot receive statutory damages. You can only receive actual damages.
And what are statutory damages?
So the statute, the law says basically if somebody steals your song at a minimum, then there's a formula, you're entitled to XYZ money, and that's what it is. And there's a formula, and it's actually quite a lot of money where you could get a huge recovery. I mean, it depends how many times they used it and whatnot, but these are large numbers, and there's a formula and rates, and it's set, and you get that money. If you are not entitled to statutory damages because you did not have a copyright registration at the time that the infringement took place, then you would have to prove actual damages, which is very difficult to prove. You have to show actual harm that you suffered as a result of this action. And you have to prove, you know, that but for this action, I would have had this money. And generally speaking, those damages end up being extremely low, where often the legal fees, and I'll say as a lawyer, most of the time, if somebody doesn't have, it's not worth it. Your legal fees will be more than you will recover in actual damages. So, you know, it's not, while you could still send a cease and desist and sort of say, stop doing it, you won't get the monetary benefit, because the idea is we really want to urge you to register your copyrights because it helps put people on notice. It helps, you know, make the whole process easier of knowing what is yours and what is already taken. And they really want to encourage recording of copyrighted material. So there's a big incentive in the law to do it. It's not, I mean, the fees are fairly low. I don't know, $55, $85, you know, it's not, it's not expensive. And you, I'm sure there are services and lawyers that, you know, will not be that expensive to do it. It's probably not something you're going to do 100% on your own, but there's certainly cost-effective ways to do it where we're talking, you know, hundreds of dollars, not, you know, massive amounts. And also having registrations for your copyright, aside from the fact that it allows you to protect it in a much easier, and it's evidence that you, you know, that you own it. When you want to go to say to someone, you're stealing my work. Well, who says, well, what, you know, like I have this registration and it's sort of definitive proof that, you know, this was an original thing that you created and there's a record of it. And it's kind of cool. You know, in general, you get a nice certificate with a, like a gold seal. But it's also makes it much easier, you know, if you have, if you build a catalog, if you're really building a career in the business and you want to one day sell your catalog, you know, you're going to, you know, to have the registrations, it makes it a much more valuable asset. Most of the time, if you are signed to a label of some sort, they will often do it for you. Mm-hmm. And because they have the same incentive, if not more, to protect it because they're making money off of it as well. But at the same time, you know, you could be independent and you could put out songs and, you know, on TuneCore or whatnot and generate some strong, you know, revenue streams for yourself. And you could go and register your copyrights, and then you could go one day and find someone who wants to buy that. You know, you have that option, as well as, you know, going against other people. And it'll help you if somebody comes at you, because it's also a lot of these times, even though you think you created something original, sometimes that's debatable. And, you know, because we all, there's only so many music notes that exist in the world. We all pull, you know, from things that we've heard and that we know. And so it would help you as well, just, you know, from a legal standpoint, if you're ever in that dispute. I mean, there's also a musicologist who comes in and analyzes the differences, but it would certainly help you in your favor to have a registration for your creation.
We don't have to talk about the details, but have you personally been involved in that kind of case where you had to have a musicologist come in and like analyze the sheet music?
Yeah, I mean, of course. So anytime you have a copyright infringement case, I mean, most of the time they settle, but if they don't and you know, really need to get to the bottom of it, yes, that's part of what happens. And I will say musicologists are expensive and they are amazing. And I, you know, they can analyze music on a level that, you know, is beyond me, where they can just really get to the bottom of the exact combination of chord progressions and this, you know, and really drill down in the data about, you know, the percentage to which some melody is the same or different from another one. And then, you know, what the exposure likely was and what the probability that, you know, affected what somebody else created. But yeah, and it gets super interesting and very technical, but you know, sometimes you have to do it because you have to get to the bottom of, was this original? Because if it's original, you should get all of these exclusive bundles of rights. But if it's not, and you're really taking from somebody else, then, you know, that's not fair. And we need to kind of figure it out. And there have definitely been some very high profile cases. You know, everyone knows, I think, like the Vanilla Ice case that happened, and, you know, got very, and there was a Blurred Lines one too, that was pretty high profile. But they happen on the less high profile level as well.
Interesting. Yeah. It seems like this pops up, you know, every few months there's a Blurred Lines or Olivia Rodrigo and Paramore. And as there's always one that's kind of floating around as the cautionary tale. So if in the event of, you know, that you're using someone else's music or a famous line or, you know, a sample, some kind of portion of someone else's song, in the event that you can't get permission for using that, is there a way to use it, to like register it to the original songwriter? Or is there a way to do it without getting permission? Or do you have to get permission every time?
You have to get permission. And I would say, unless you're Kanye West, who sometimes just says, I'm going to do it, sue me and we'll figure it out, and I'll pay you what I owe you later, because, you know, whatever amount you sue me for, I have, and, you know, this is what I want to do, which is, he sometimes does that, you know. And particularly in hip hop, where sampling is so prevalent, some, like, I represent a lot of hip hop artists, and we do try to clear everything, and especially at a label, they will put a team of lawyers and a lot of work and get everything cleared before it goes out. But, you know, there's other factors. Sometimes they say, just do it and we'll deal with it after the fact. But
does that make you a little twitchy?
Yeah. I mean, look, it's, you know, and sometimes it's even worse when you get into court. I mean, the worst part is if you get into court and you say, no, we actually asked and they said no, and we went ahead and did it anyway, that the court does not like that, you know. But the particularly if what you're sampling, if these are registered copyrights, I mean, you're going to end up paying a lot of money, and the money is going to be that, you know, you're going to have statutory damages, and you're, you know, if it's a big hit, you know, it could take away from, I mean, you could end up paying royalties to these people, you know, for forever. So I mean, it's much better to get ahead of it. I mean, and most there's sort of standard norms about, you know, rates and things. And, you know, if you ask, people generally say yes and just pay me this money and that's it. And, you know, sometimes labels will trade too. You could do, I mean, if you're, you know, you can say, hey, I want to, you know, get this clearance for this. You'll give me what, you'll do this on my song. I did this on your song, you know, and sometimes we'll just trade, but definitely, you know, same thing. It's somebody's property and, you know, it's the same thing as going into their house and stealing their microwave and saying, you know, I wanted to use it, so I'm taking it, and I didn't feel I needed to ask.
Right. Right.
You know,
yeah. Yeah.
You have to do it. And I think it's great too. I mean, if you think about it, I've seen many cases where whomever was sampled just does not like the music or the person that sampled them. And now they're associated with them. And, you know, like, just for example, there are some hip hop artists that have used some 80s, like soft rock, you know, and whatever it is, these original artists are not a fan of the new genre. They don't want to be associated with it. And the money, you know, they're very upset. And I think to some extent, it's not fair. Their song to a whole generation is associated with the new artist. They don't even remember the original. So, you know, to kind of do that to somebody without asking them is not cool. I mean, sometimes people sample things as little as like a drum beat that's hardly recognizable. I mean, you still should get the proper clearances. And if it's not that special and unique, there's often a way to find a version of what you want that you can clear. And like I said, you know, you have to clear on both sides too. Whenever you use something, there's the composition and there's the master. And if you can't get clearance on the master, sometimes you can re-record something that's a sound alike essentially and get a new master, but you're going to have to clear on the publishing side, you know, if you want that exact, you know, lyrics or chord progression or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's what they do in the Just Dance video game. They have like a team of people that'll re-record, like certain Britney Spears songs have been re-recorded. There's like specific artists that you can tell that they just couldn't work with the label, so they just re-recorded the whole thing.
Yeah, and I mean it's a much cheaper way to do it if you can. I mean, and re-records are interesting. The whole Taylor Swift drama that everyone knows about, or should know about, you know, where they her label owned her copyrights, sold them, and she was very unhappy with who they sold them to. So obviously one of the, you know, the things was, we'll re-record them, and then, you know, the value of the originals will go down, everyone will listen to the new ones, and, you know, you won't be making money for them. I've heard that, or I know that Universal has subsequently beefed up their, I mean, most recording agreements have re-record restrictions anyway, but usually for a certain period of time, you know, for 5 years or 10, whatever, you won't re-record it, because if you re-record something and it sounds pretty much like the original, you know, you've just devalued the original. I mean, real fans will say, oh, I want the version from, you know, 1987 that was recorded at blah, blah, blah. But yeah, most people will listen to whatever version is easiest to get to. But they've beefed up their re-record restrictions in the post Taylor Swift era. But, you know, I think it was successful for her. I think she re-recorded the Red album, and I think, I don't know for sure, but I think the remastered versions are, you know, now being streamed more than the originals.
Yeah. And she publicized it so much too, going on talk shows and saying, play the Taylor's version, because then it's coming directly to me. But she also put herself in a good position there by holding on to her publishing copyright, the composition, or she wouldn't have been able to re-record because she would have been violating both copyrights.
Yeah. So publishing in general is more valuable usually than the masters. When we do sales, they just are. I mean, and also because you can make a new master, you can't make, you know, you can't, the song is what it is. It tends to be evergreen. You could have more, you know, the person who wrote I Will Always Love You, Dolly Parton, made so much money off of Whitney Houston's version of that song, you know.
Yeah.
She also sang it, didn't matter, you know, but the life of a song when you write it is just so much longer than a master. And it can, because you can take different, you know, voices, different takes, all of that. The law in terms of the rates is just, it's just much more valuable, more favorable. The exclusive bundle that you get of rights, it's a little bit better with the song than it is with the master. So if you want to be an artist, write your own songs. That is definitely the way to go to make the most money. And, you know, also will help you not doing covers, because every time you do a cover, you have to keep paying people money. So write your own songs if you can, if you know how. And you know, I mean, there are some, you know, if you write the right song, I mean, there are some people, one song is hundreds of millions of dollars off that one song, you know, if it's good enough. Yeah. And you don't have to, you know, other people will go out and perform it and do the work for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's, you can just sit back and collect the money. But yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about how, if two people are writing a song together and they both want to publish it, what a process could be for that, what it would look like on the copyright side. And, you know, maybe one person is involved with the master recording, but another person isn't, they were just a writer. I'm sure you see situations like this all the time, but specifically talking to the younger students who maybe are like hesitant to co-write because they aren't really sure what a split would look like or how to even figure out the percentages. If you have any advice for specifically for, you know, people who are about to graduate from college and start going out on these co-writes and start making music with other people.
Sure. So my number one recommendation, and it happens all the time, I mean, very rarely actually, is a song 100% one person. I mean, it happens, but there's often co-writers, and particularly every band, a lot of bands, you know, split it up. Sometimes some of them just say there's four members, every song we're going to give, you know, we're going to be collaborative in the room and everyone gets 25%. Sometimes they do the splits based on what actually happened, where they say, you know, you really did the majority of this and I wrote, you know, five lines and what percentage, you know, they do it. But my number one recommendation is agree in writing on what you're going to do. Don't just, and it can be, you know, a lot of times, obviously, you know, talk about it. And after the fact, even if you just something, you know, the writer splits for this song are blah, 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 on a piece of paper, you know, something, because what happens in the absence of a writing is a little bit complicated in terms of who can control it. It's a joint work. It's a little bit tricky, but generally speaking, you have your share and another writer has their share. You can administer your own shares, meaning you can each have your separate publishers if you eventually sign with a publisher who will run your percentage, and they can be licensed separately, and you know, you can just get your royalties for your percentage, and everything can be worked out nice and easy if people know what the splits are. If there's any dispute there or it's just not agreed on, and a lot of times people forget, you know, after a while, or they change their mind. So just writing it down and making sure you're on the same page is super important. But it's also, so there, like with everything, there's two aspects to it. There's control, who administers it, meaning who gets to make the decisions about whether to license it for particular uses. And then the second piece is the money. You know, even if I don't, if somebody administers 100%, but I have a 25% interest, that just means when they make the decision, I get 25% of the money. And, you know, when you have a band, sometimes you have an entity that you form, which is what you should do, that can kind of have administrative control. And then they can say, okay, I'm going to take 100% of this song and give it to one publisher, who's now going to be able to go out and say, I want to put this. So what a publisher does is they work for you, and they find ways to get your music in TV commercials or, you know, internet ads. They shop it around to see if other, you know, who wants to record it, who wants to do a cover. And most importantly, they make sure that you get your money, that you collect it. So if it's recorded in different places and then it's played, you know, in a restaurant or a radio or, you know, whatever, they go out and find that money for you and make sure they collect it, make sure they get what they need to get, the royalties from the streaming services, all of that. And they do all the accounting and then they pay you. And they take a percentage off the top, and there's usually different percentages for different types of uses that they get for you. But you know, you want to have a publisher, because they will make your songs make more money, and they will collect money that you never would have been able to collect on your own. So you can have your company or your entity give it to one publisher, which makes life easier because then if somebody wants to use the song, they just have to ask one person. And, you know, if you tell a TV commercial, I love this song, but I need permission from seven different people, they're like, forget it. Let me go to the next person. You know, this is too annoying. But if, you know, oh, 100% is controlled by this one person, but there's actually seven people who wrote it, you just pay us out like this. You know, that's generally how it would work. And even if, you know, you have this entity that's controls 100%, you can then have an agreement about that entity that says, well, this is how we're going to make decisions. We're going to have a vote and majority vote's going to win. Or, you know, if 100% of us don't agree, the answer is no, whatever. So that it's not like, you know, you're really giving up control, but you're just making it easier for the people who want to use it to, you know, they don't care whatever your process of having a vote is, but they just have to get one yes. And then that's it. And then you could split up, you know, the royalties as well. But it's very common. And I mean, I can't speak to this from a creative person, but even, you know, most people the writers that I work with, they tend to get, you know, having another co-writer partner helps them be creative, helps, you know, it's a good atmosphere in, you know, the room when you collaborate, which works with anything that you do, really. Collaboration, I think, is helpful, but, you know, just try to, you know, collaborate with people that you respect and you get along, you know, and have an understanding of what you're doing, and that, you know, hey, we're just going to bounce ideas off of each other and we're totally cool. Everything's going to be split 50-50, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or, well, let's just work. And then at the end, we'll look at it and, you know, we'll look at it line by line and who wrote what. And then we'll, you know, however you get, it's like splitting the tip, you know, when you go out to a restaurant. Some people are like, I'm going to look at exactly what you ordered and, you know, you owe 7 cents. And, you know, and some people are like, we're going to go out to eat seven times. We'll just split it every time. Sometimes they'll come out ahead. Sometimes they won't. I will say I have seen the most successful bands. So we have a lot of bands and you see a lot of them that split up and some that stay together. The ones that tend to keep everything equal are the ones that tend to go the long run. I mean, it's just an observation, but I've seen a lot where everyone just agrees that we are not going to get into it and we're a team and, you know, everything is equal, tend to go the long run. I mean, obviously if that's not your situation, if you're like, I do 90% of the work here, you know, like any group project, I guess. But if you can find people that you feel, I don't know, like have as much to contribute as you do and you guys can work together, you know, those things, I see a lot of writing duos that tend to do really well. And then you can sort of stay together as a package too. Like I have a lot of writer groups that have been teams their whole career and we package them together in terms of all of their songs and we sell them together or we sign them to deals together. And, you know, for everyone, they're kind of a team and they're one person and they do really well and they split everything 50-50 and, you know, it's like a little business marriage and it works out really well. There was a school, I can't, but when hip hop, because hip hop is obviously very heavily on the writing and the lyrics. And there was a hip hop school that around the time of like, I don't know, maybe like Fresh Prince when that first came out in some pockets where some rappers started these schools where they felt like they were teaching just, you know, it was just, when I say school, it was just like, hey, I've been successful. I want to have a workshop and bring people in. There's a bunch of graduates of some of, we'll call them graduates of some of these schools who they would just meet. They just on their own, they said like, hey, every Thursday at 3 o'clock, we're going to have a writing workshop and, you know, everyone come around and do it. And then, you know, they kind of did that for some years. And then some of them, they came out and some of them, particularly people who started, became very successful. And so they sort of started talking about it. You know, this is the school that we have. And if, you know, if you want to join and come be part of it and, you know, whatever happens in the school, you know, nobody's commercializing that, but a lot of relationships were made there and then teams broke off and then started writing together from there and have been super successful. And then they connected them with, you know, some of these writers never actually, you wouldn't know their names because they never recorded, but, you know, they've written all of the, you know, hits for major, you know, they connected them with, hey, this is a person who's going to, you know, there's a, especially in hip hop rap, there's a lot of, you know, sort of, I don't know, ghostwriting is the right term, because it's not totally ghost. Cause if you look at the liner notes or whatever, they'll tell you, but a lot of people writing for other people, because the having a good flow and sounding good is often different than having the skills to come up with the rhymes. And so that's also another team that you will see. Some people write it, but they just don't, it just doesn't come out as well. And some people have a better, they say it better with the beat, you know, they just, something about their voice, better flow, I guess. And you'll see those teams too, where obviously then someone is getting, you know, much more on the publishing side and somebody's getting on the master side, and they kind of want to work it out that way. But I mean, it's hard to do it, to do everything yourself, but obviously, you know, the singer songwriters who play multiple instruments and write their own songs and music and say, I mean, and don't have to pay anyone, they've got a larger bucket of money. Yeah. But that's hard.
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a minute, and the work for hire concept of where it's you know, I keep thinking about Trent Reznor. I've thought about Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails and a few times during this conversation, because one of my favorite copyright sample lessons is Old Town Road. And the way that I understood the story going was that the producer didn't necessarily make a big deal about the fact that he was using a very small banjo sample in there, but then Nine Inch Nails heard it and said, hey, that's ours, you know? And so there's like all these different levels of, I just wanted to say that that's not really relevant to the next part that I'm going to talk about. But when you have like a singer songwriter who plays multiple instruments and needs to bring people in to kind of fill in the spaces, either in the studio or live, and they have them sign a work for hire, can you explain the difference between that form versus a split sheet and what that means for like copyright ownership or lack thereof?
Sure. So the best way when you get someone else to work on it is to say, I'm going to own what you make. You are my, for all intents and purposes, my employee. I am. And the law allows you to do that, where you, someone can create something because you ask them to do it and for you, and you will own it. And that's called a work made for hire, where, so you usually pay them a lump sum. I'm paying you $2,000 to come in today and sing this lot, a couple lines, or play this instrument or do something. And I will pay you that fee and I will own what you did. You have no more rights to it, done. So I don't ever have to go back to you. You don't get an ongoing royalty and your permission is not needed. And I have, that's sort of the traditional way that a lot of these, we call them session musicians, is done on a work for hire basis, where, you know, and it would just be too unruly. The more people that you have that are owning a piece of this copyright, the more annoying it is, hard it is to exploit that copyright, because every time you need a license, every time you need a permission, you want to go to one person. You want, you know, maybe two people. You don't want to have to ask a million people. So if you're an artist and everyone who helps you, you can get them to give you work for hire, so you own their share, then you can go and bring it to someone and say, this is 100% of it. And then I'll deal with the fact that I owe this person $5 or $5,000 or whatever the deal that you make. But that's how those are kind of done. Similarly, back in the day, and still a little bit now, but when it was just a given that, you know, every label was going to own the copyrights in their artist's work, they were all done on work for hire basis. So same thing, you were like an employee of the label, and whatever you did while you were signed to that label, the label owned, and mm-hmm. and they owned it from the minute that you created it. So it's theirs and they can do what they want to do with it. And they have whatever deal they have with you, where they may say, we're paying you royalties for, you know, whatever, 50 cents for every copy that we sell, maybe in perpetuity, but we own it. So that means that we can sell it if we want, we can, you know, control the how it's used, all of that. Here's your monetary, you know, participation, but we own it. if something is not a work made for hire, then the only other way you can have permission is to have an assignment or a license, which, you know, sometimes in practice, it can work out. If you have a perpetual license, it's almost the same thing, you know, as saying, I sold it to you. But licenses can be terminated much more easily, and you can have a reason where you get it back. And that's actually something that has been written into the copyright law now, that if you make a license or an assignment for a copyright, particularly in a composition, 35 years after you make that first assignment, there's a window that you have where you can send certain notices and do certain things where you have an opportunity to cancel it and take it back. Mm. And that was sort of given fairly recently to creators to say, hey, we know that a lot of, you know, artists when they're young in their careers give up the rights to their property and it explodes in value and they miss out on that, you know, because there was no way for them to sort of have known at the time that they agreed to give it up, you know, what the real value was. You know, they gave it up for $10,000. It's now made their label $10 million, whatever the deal is. They should get a second chance to, you know, to get it back. And so this concept was written in, and it's 35 years from the first assignment. It does not apply in the context of a work for hire because you never owned it in the first place. In a work for hire, you did it as an employee for someone else's benefit. So, and there's a couple other legal distinctions between an assignment and a work for hire, but where, you know, as the person getting it, you want the work for hire, you get the more rights there. But the other option is a license, which can be for, you know, in perpetuity or for any duration. And if you have a license, you have to be more specific about, this is a license to use this when and in what context, and, you know, what are the exact permissions I'm giving you? Whereas work for hire is, I never owned it in the first place. It's yours and I did it for you. So, I mean, the custom and generally minor, or I shouldn't say minor, but session musicians and people just coming in to sing little bits and that kind of stuff, you know, they generally do a lot of that stuff on a work for hire basis. But it's more likely when you have co-writing that the individual parties keep ownership in what they wrote. Mm-hmm. So that's why you have a split, because you're going to keep owning 25% and I'm going to own 75%, and 100% of the control might go over here, but we sort of say you still own what you wrote, as opposed to with the session musicians. And depending if you have a featured artist, you know, if you're bringing up and it's someone with a name who's really, you know, singing on it, I mean, you still might do a work for hire there so that 100% of the master can be owned by one party. That's just sort of the custom, that the master ownership stays in one place, whereas the composition ownership is split, but you're more likely to have an ongoing royalty if you are on the master side, if you even, you know, if you contribute as a featured artist or something like that.
You read my mind right there, because I was wondering, is a featured vocalist a work for hire if then they get that added royalty of being a featured vocalist? Can you do both?
Yes. So, I mean, all of this is contractual. You can agree, you know, in the agreement that the compensation is however you want it to be, lump sum or ongoing royalty or whatever you want it to do. But you're generally agreeing, and you can agree with anyone to whatever terms you want, but, you know, who is going to own it for the purpose of, you know, an asset that's owned, who is going to control it, and how is the money going to be split, you know? And you can vary those things however you agree. And there are customs and, you know, standards, and there's leverage, and, you know, in terms of who's got more bargaining power, who's better well-known, you know, all of that, and traditions and all and that. But essentially, you can make whatever deal you want to make.
I think that you just hit the nail on the head so accurately of what makes this so confusing. you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. I mean, you know, cause at the end of the day, everything is an agreement, among the people who are, you know, participating. I mean, once you agree to certain terms, then they are what they are, and then people have to abide by them. And so when I say you can do what you want, if you sign a recording agreement that says my label's going to own everything that I, you know, that I record, then, you know, you can't go and subsequently sell what you did to somebody else. You know, that would be wrong. But when you start, you know, until you agree to something, we have sort of have this idea of freedom of contract. You can agree to any terms that you want to agree with anybody unless it, you know, violates a law.
Sure. And
generally there are ways that, like, the industry says deals are done, but, you know, and the way that independents tend to do things and the way that majors tend to do things, you know, are different. So, you know, there's always people making their own unique deals, how they want to do them. But I think the thing to keep in mind too is whenever you're making a deal, I mean, what is the plan for use of it? You know, mm-hmm. be on the same page. Are you trying to get signed to a major? Are you trying to shop this there? You know, do you see yourself at an indie label? Do you plan to put these out, you know, yourself? Do you see this as something that's likely to be something that could potentially be used in sync licensing, which is what, you know, traditionally it meant when in TV or film, but now it's everything. Peloton, you know, mm-hmm. uses a lot of, or exercise apps use music all the time. And you have so many of them, and they're often looking for people. They don't want, it's too expensive to get, you know, Britney Spears music, you know, yeah. they want, you know, someone, college graduate in their house, you know, who just made a song that sounds good to exercise to, you know, mm-hmm. and there are a lot of these micro sync companies that you can sign up with and have no name, no followers, no, you know, but just give them the music and they will shop it around to various apps and other companies that need to use music, because technically you need a license to use any music that you're using in anything commercial that you're doing. So there is a big market for, like, and there's so many apps out there and programs that, you know, that can't afford to use names of people that we know. So you can be making a good income licensing your music through various ways without, you know, being on the radio or anything yeah. like that. So while you make music, you know, and certain music lends itself to that kind of stuff and certain music doesn't. So what, you know, thinking about what type of music you're making and ultimately what your plan is, you know, no one has a crystal ball and everyone wants their music to be, you know, huge hit and make lots of money, but you tend to have a plan about, at least this is the way I think I'm going to try to get this out there. This is the way I think, you know, it's going to make money. Might change a little bit, you know, how you decide to go about creating it.
Yeah. I thought about this concept earlier when you were talking about the older soft rock person who didn't want their sample being used in hip hop. This is one of my favorite sync licensing examples to use with the students, is if you have a song about, like, that was a Christian song and it was about him and how I love him and he is my God or he is whatever, but somebody used that song to put it in a video of about the devil and it was like a Satanist video, then it completely changes the tone of the original song and takes away the intention of the original artist.
Yep.
And that's the example that I give the students of why you have to get permission every single time, because the creator has the right to say yes or no, I don't want my song representing these visuals. And you just made me think of it again just now, because it's just such an important concept to have control and goals and an idea of what your bigger picture is and how you want your music to be used. Because if you don't go in with those kinds of goals, then when a brand comes to you and asks you for permission, you don't have any filter to run it through of, like, does this meet my core values? Is this something that's important to me? Is this how I want my artistry represented? So I always have my students kind of start with those goals and values as a really fundamental part of their art, so that when it comes time to license it, they have some sort of filtering mechanism.
Yeah, and I mean, you bring up a very interesting thing. So there's some people, like Snoop Dogg. I mean, he will anything. Give me money. You could use it. I'll put it. I'll do Martha Stewart. I'll do, you know, Gang Affiliate. I don't care. And maybe he's Snoop Dogg enough that, you know, he kind of fits into all of those places. But, you know, you create for other people, you have to be much more selective. And you know, if you, and a lot of people, so a big thing that's always negotiated is artists usually want some approval rights, even if they give their label or their publisher the right to do this. They say, but if it's going to be about alcohol, or it's going to be about cigarettes, or it's going to be, you know, pornography, or it's going to be political is always a huge one. You know, I need to have a say in that. And that's something that's happened a lot, actually. Campaigns, political campaigns, play music at their rallies, and there's usually the person whose music they're playing often comes out and says, stop doing that. You know, I'm not okay with it. And most of the time, you know, depending on how it, the context of how they're using it and whatnot, but then if it gets filmed and, you know, various licenses that you should have had, and usually people negotiate the rights to control those sensitive uses. But, you know, there's a concept that exists in European and pretty much, I don't know, every country, but a lot of foreign countries, though, that does not exist in the US, of this concept of moral rights, is what they call them, where the rest of the world recognizes that art is a function of the person who created it, and that there's no price you can put on certain rights you can't give up. The US says everything has a price, and you can give away all your consent rights and all of everything if you want to for the right amount of money. And so, but your piece is, there are sort of these innate rights that you can, if something, if the use of your art is so offensive to you morally, no matter what you signed or whatever, you know, you sort of have certain rights to prevent, you know, sort of uses against your morals is kind of the concept of your art. The idea in the US is, you know, it allows for much more capitalism in a sense, when you don't have to worry about moral rights, because people can contract to do things, and you can have business. And at the end of the day, if you want to sell, you know, whatever it is, your soul, you can sell your soul if you want to and get money.
That's but American, it's a good dream.
Yeah. You will see in a lot of other countries, which sometimes is difficult to work with, because, you know, you have to be afraid that, you know, certain rights you cannot get from the artist as someone who wants to go and take it and use it. You know, are they going to come back and sue me for breach of moral rights or whatever? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the concept that it is your creation, something that, you know, your art that can never be separated from you is an interesting, you know, concept that is contrary to what you see sometimes, where sometimes artists have given up these rights, and then their music is used in a way that is absolutely, they hate, you know, and there's nothing they can do about it. And, you know, but, you know, thinking about, I think that's very, very true, right? Thinking about how you want your music to be used and, you know, viewed by the public and all of that should be in your mind during the creation process. And every step of the way, every decision you make is going to affect, I mean, with a lot of, but particularly with music, it creates a perception. You know, if you kind of start, you know, being seen in one kind of context, the public has a hard time, you know, moving you to another one. So, you know, if you, like you say, see yourself ultimately as like a Christian rocker, and you get some deal to make a lot of money to use, you know, maybe even without lyrics, just some beat that you created in a, I don't know, a commercial for something very unchristian. Mm-hmm. One is going to affect the other, you know, so you should think about, because as an artist, particularly in our country, you get put in a box, you know, I mean, and at least where you want to go, what you want to be known as, and what kind of path you want to take to get there.
Yeah. This is all so interesting. I could talk to you all day.
Yeah.
I know we're over time, so I don't want to take up too much more of your time. But we didn't get a chance to really talk about you at all, which this is going to be super valuable legal information for all of my students. But just one last question for you before we wrap up. What have you been listening to lately?
Wow. So, I mean, well, on the one hand, I do try to sort of support my clients and whatnot. So when, you know, they have a new album coming out or I've just done a deal with them, you know, I always sort of add some of their songs into my mix on Spotify. Nice. But at its core, I am probably mostly listening to hip hop. That's kind of, and, you know, I like the sort of throwback. There's a new station in New York, at least, called like the Throwback Station. So it's like 90s hip hop, which is kind of my wheelhouse. Like, you know, I don't even know, like Camp Low and, you know, like back in the day type stuff. But that's sort of my favorite. And then obviously I'm the gym running, exercising is probably when I have the time. I work out for pretty long, like an hour at least. And I, you know, listen to music that whole time. But when I work out, I like poppy dance, you know, like feel good, Britney Spears type music.
I would absolutely love to see that playlist. Yeah. That's my jam. I like it if it's happy and poppy and has a good beat and makes me want to dance.
Yes. And my son also, so my son is, he's, I guess, 18 months, 19 months now. And, you know, obviously we have the baby songs, the Sesame Street, but he's super into, you know, the music will change his whole mood, but, you know, and we play a lot of the, something just like the Justin Timberlake control song, whatever that one is, you know, and it drives him crazy. It's like so funny how much of a good mood it puts him in, you know, he just wants to dance like a crazy person. And like Pharrell, Happy, and, you know, those kind of songs. It's fun to see how much they affect the moods of kids. That's something I've noticed too. How the it, a very pure effect where if I play a quieter bedtime song, totally changes the like sitting down, calm, reading a book. I play a crazy song and I'm running around, you know. I mean, I try not to play sad, but just sort of at its core, the way that music can affect, you know, like as adults, we're driving in the car, sad song, you know, I think we don't even realize consciously how much the music is affecting us, but you can see with kids how much their mood can be affected by the music. So I do like to keep it happy and upbeat when I'm not listening to like Eminem or something, which is not happy and upbeat.
Yeah. Yeah. Eminem's our local hero.
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm obviously a big Eminem fan, I think.
Nice. If you're ever in Detroit, let me know. I'll show you around.
For sure, definitely. Well, this was so great, and I really enjoyed it. And I hope it was at least. I know I talked a lot, but I hope it was helpful.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Absolutely. This I love these kinds of conversations, and they're the ones that I always want to have with my students. But I don't necessarily want to say the wrong thing. I'm like very cautious about giving bad legal advice. I would just feel so terrible if I told somebody the wrong thing. So thank you for bringing your expertise to our students. I really appreciate it. And if people want to reach out to you, is there a way for them to find you?
Yes, definitely. So email is probably the best. It's CKATZ @ Fox Rothschild, FOXROTHSCHILD. Fox Rothschild is the name of the firm. If you Google it, you can look me up. My name is Cynthia, last name Katz. We have a pretty big and I think impressive music department. So anyone who is in the music business, looking to get into the music business, has some opportunities, needs some guidance, career, legal, please reach out and love to chat.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great. Have a good day.
You too. When Songs Mean Business is a production of Steph Belcher Business Management, LLC. This episode was hosted, edited, and produced by me, Steph Belcher. Please make sure to join us in our Facebook group, When Songs Mean Business, and follow us on Instagram @ When Songs Mean Business. As always, thank you to The Dropout for the break music. Thank you so much for listening and have a wonderful day.